today we finally have our formal discussion of kinetic versus thermodynamic control. As you might imagine, we're going to have a very brief review of kinetics, which means, yes, we're going to have to go once more briefly into what a reaction coordinate diagram is. I might even bring up scary things from the past, like the Arrhenius expression, because we're going to be talking a lot about activation energy and temperature and their effect on rate of reaction. And what we're going to talk about is a situation in which the stability of the product is not directly related to the stability of the transition state to get to that product. So many reactions have a reaction coordinate diagram as follows. If you have one set of starting materials, that maybe there's two different reactions that possibly could occur. Those two different reactions might have two different mechanisms, and they could end up possibly forming energies with two different products. And this is the sort of normal situation where the product that's higher in energy also has the larger activation barrier. But what we're going to talk about today is this situation. Where there's a reversal between product stability and the energy of the transition state, the activation energy necessary to get there. What's going to be a result of this is that the product that forms is going to be as a result of temperature. Higher temperature is going to favor what's known as the thermodynamic product, the one that is the lowest in energy but takes the most energy to get to. At low temperatures, we're going to find that we favor the formation of the kinetic product, the one that is thermodynamically not as favorable, but the one that's the easier reaction. So before we get to any of that, let's review what one of these reaction coordinate diagrams is. And this is more for the couple of new people that we have. Can someone describe to me what is a reaction coordinate diagram? Yes. Okay, it's a pathway from reactants to products, and it's the most likely pathway, the energetically most favorable pathway. What we could, in theory, do is plot out the position of all the different atoms in the system and figure out what the energy is relative to the position of each one of those atoms, but that creates a graph that's multidimensional, hard to interpret. So we take a two-dimensional slice along the most likely pathway, and we say, what's going to be the energy change as we go along that pathway, which that's what we call the reaction coordinate. So if we're reviewing, let me just write this much down. The reaction coordinate is the energetically most likely pathway through a reaction. It's also a 2D simplification of a multidimensional space. And there are several key features that we generally identify in one of these reaction coordinate diagrams. To simplify our discussion, I'm going to keep us in the land of enthalpy. You might recall that there's a difference between enthalpy, which is the raw difference in energy between reactants and products, and then delta G, which is free energy, which is the amount of potential energy really available to a reaction once you take this thing called entropy into account. Don't really want to get much into what entropy is today, kind of sidesteps us from the real discussion. So we're going to stick with delta H. So on a graph like this, let's label all the things that normally would be important. We have the reactants products, and then I for intermediate.
Good morning, Neutron.
We have two what are called transition states. Which are the highest energy points between a reactant and either the product or the intermediate that's formed. So in a multi-step reaction, each time you go through a step, there's the toughest point in that step, and that's the transition state. Hammond postulate says the energy of the transition state the structure of the transition state tends to match more closely what the transition state matches in energy. Which this is just some random reaction, so don't worry about exactly the reactants involved. I'm just recounting that there is this thing called the Hammond postulate. There are a couple more things on this graph that I would want to mark. There are two different activation energies. And then there is the overall heat of reaction. Now, why do we care about activation energy? Or even before I ask that, let's review a couple of fundamentals of kinetics. How many steps are there in this reaction? How did you know that? So the number of activation energies is equal to the number of steps, because if the activation energy is the highest point in a step, and you see two activation energies, that means you had two steps. So number of transition states equals the number of individual steps. Can you tell how many reactants are participating in this reaction? So is there any correlation between the number of steps and the number of reagents? All right. Normally when we write chemical equations, chemical reactions, they express an entire reaction, which would mean from the start to finish of this process. Is there going to be any relationship then between the number of reagents in that overall expression and the number of reagents in any one particular step? Which, if you recall, this thing called the rate law. The rate law is composed of a constant plus a certain number of concentration terms. Only those concentrations of those reagents that participate in one particular step in the reaction are found in that equation. So there's no relationship between the overall equation for a reaction versus the rate law versus the number of reagents. There's no correspondence between any of those things. To simplify, what we could say is only those reagents in the rate-limiting step are found in the rate law. How do we know which reagents are in the rate-limiting step? The step that has the highest activation barrier. So that's why we care about activation energy, because everything else being equal, that's what's going to control the rate of reaction. And that's where we're going next, is what things affect rate. So only those reagents in the rate-limiting step which I'm going to abbreviate RLS are found in the rate law. Another way of saying it is there's no relationship between the number of reagents in the overall stoichiometric equation and the rate law itself. right, next bit of review. The Arrhenius expression. How many of you would have been able to remember that if I hadn't written it down? What are these variables that are in the expression? You better be able to get T. Temperature, thank you. This is not physics class, so usually when you see T, it's temperature, not time. What else do we have? R, which is not a variable, it's a constant. So what are the other variables? Activation energy, EA. Then what's A? So there's a couple of ways of expressing what it is. It's sometimes called the Arrhenius factor, sometimes called the steric factor, sometimes labeled as the percentage of successful collisions. So in other words, you might know what the total number of collisions could be based on temperature and activation energy, and how many of those might be successful are rolled up into that A. A is kind of a fudge factor just to make the rest of the equation actually work out. Just as a very quick reminder, why do temperature and activation energy matter? Because at any one temperature, there's not just one speed or one energy that molecules are traveling with, there's a distribution. Which there's two graphs that matter in this case. One where you show one activation energy versus what happens when we have two different temperatures. The other one is where we're sticking to one temperature, but we're looking at the difference between two different activation energies. In both cases, the x-axes are number of molecules, whereas the x-axis is the energy per molecule. And these graphs come from the fact that even if you had a room full of molecules that somehow were all magically traveling exactly the same speed, as soon as you blink, they all start bouncing into each other, which means some get knocked around, some move more quickly, some move more slowly. So let's tackle the second graph first, because that's with temperature. So as you increase temperature, more molecules bouncing around, more possible energy states. That's why the graph shifts to the right, and it gets flattened. Because the total number of molecules stays the same. But what it shows is that at higher temperature, you have a higher fraction of molecules that are over some kind of energy barrier, which in this case, this is activation energy, which means the ability to react. So more molecules have that energy necessary to react. And then in the other case here, we go up a higher activation energy. Well, we could see that at the same temperature, fewer molecules have that energy, and so fewer reactions, successful ones, could occur. That's a review of Kinetics, really super duper briefly. We're not going to even get into how do we determine rate laws, so method of initial rates versus integrated rate law, we don't care about that. We do care about these energy diagrams because we need to know the effect of temperature and activation energy, and we care about reaction coordinate diagrams because that's how we're going to discuss kinetic versus thermodynamic control. So any questions before we move on? Yeah. So diagram one is just one temperature. Is low temperature and high temperature. Other questions? Yeah. You need to know the equation. You need to know these graphs. Were you to ask to incorporate any of this into one of your answers on this topic? Well, now let's go to reversible reaction. One last preliminary energy diagram. And for this, we're going to imagine some kind of perfect reaction where in both the forward and reverse reactions, there's only one molecule involved, there's only one reaction step, and the steric factor, that Arrhenius factor, is equivalent in both directions. So it's a very contrived example, but it lets us get at something really important. So some idealized reaction, A reversibly forming back and forth into B. We'll say both the forward and reverse reactions are one step first order with the same steric factor. So we could label the activation energy of the forward reaction and the activation energy of the reverse. The reason that I came up with these contrived conditions is I'm going to exploit one of the definitions of equilibrium. Because we're talking about reversible processes whenever we're talking about kinetic versus thermodynamic control, or at least we're talking about the potential to have reversibility. So if we're talking about reversibility, we're talking about a situation where you should have some form of equilibrium. What are our definitions of equilibrium? So there's no observable change in the concentrations of products reactants. You're at the lowest energy, and the one that matters here, the rate of the forward and reverse processes are equal. Well, in this case, the rate of the forward reaction is equal to the rate constant of the forward reaction times the concentration of A, because I said that it is a one-step reaction. The rate of the reverse reaction is equal to some reverse rate constant times the concentration of B. And if at equilibrium these two expressions are supposed to be equal to each other, Then we get something like this. Reason I point this out is because the rates may be equal, but there's no way the rate constants can be equal. Why? Because the activation energies are different. And this is why we're going to have a distribution of A versus B. Now, let's look at this. The forward rate constant is going to be big because the activation barrier is small. The reverse rate constant is going to be small because the activation barrier is big. For that equation to hold true, if you have a small forward rate constant, that means if you have a large forward rate constant, the amount of A at equilibrium has to be small in order to get this proportionality to be equal, so that you have a small reverse rate constant, which is going to mean that you have to have a large concentration of B. So rates are equal, but rate constants are not. And in this ideal situation, the fact you have two different rates is why you have a difference between the concentration of products and reactants at equilibrium. Yes? There's a lot of reasons why this is a shaky argument to make. It turns out to be true in real life, but how often do we have a reaction where the forward reverse reactions are both one step in just one reagent and have the same steric factor? This never happens. But the same argument holds true. I'm just trying to develop for what happens when we have two competing reactions. Leave this up to that. So the main things to pull from this diagram are that at equilibrium, rates are equal, but rate constants are not. And that will influence the concentration of reactants versus concentration of the products. And in this specific example, since the activation energy of the forward reaction is less than the activation of the reverse reaction, that means the forward rate constant is larger than the reverse rate constant, which is why we end up with the concentration of A being lower than the concentration of B. Questions about this diagram or this example? Then let's finally get to both a real-life example and a discussion of kinetic versus thermodynamic control, because we have this reaction that's possible. 1,3-butadiene, which we talked about last week, being a conjugated system. When it reacts with HBr, there are two products that develop. One that might make very much sense. Alkene reacting with H+, just like we saw last quarter. Carbocation forming. And then bromide coming back to attack afterwards. So not in terms of nomenclature, but in terms of relative position. If you look where the hydrogen ended up, which I don't normally write my hydrogens in, but I'm going to this time because I want to say that if we call that position 1, then the position of the bromine relative would be 2. So this is known as 1,2 addition. But that's not the only product that results. The other product that results is for the bromine to be located at the complete opposite end of where the hydrogen ends up, which we could explain like this. That after H plus is attacked, we end up with a carbocation, then can experience resonance. And again, I'm going to write that hydrogen in. That puts the carbocation at that end of the molecule, which now bromide could attack. And so because of the relative position of the hydrogen and the bromine, we call this 1,4 addition. Now let's draw a reaction coordinate diagram for this process. There's two steps. There's the original diene attacking an H+. That's one step. And then there's the carbocation that's formed reacting with bromide to form the product. Now here's the, for this specific example, here's a pivotal question to be asked. Which of those two carbocations is more stable? Let me ask that question again. Which one of the two carbocations is more stable? How many different carbocations are there? One. Because if you have resonance, isn't it the same carbocation? We're just writing it two different ways. So it's a totally misleading question. If I ask you what's the difference or which one of these two is energetically more favorable, the answer is neither. They're both the same energy, and neither one of these structures is correct. Yeah. Oh. So what do we do then? Because there has to be some difference here. Well, there is, once the bond actually starts forming. Once you start allowing that bromide to attack, it causes the charge to become localized. So then it becomes more like a tertiary carbocation, a primary carbocation, I'm sorry, tertiary, terminal, versus the internal one, versus the one that looks like a secondary carbocation. That doesn't happen until the bond forms. Otherwise, in between, it's the same energy. That matters a huge amount because that means that whether one product or the other forms, it goes through the same energy state, through the same intermediate. Which means there's a direct competition for which product occurs. So here's what the reaction coordinate diagram looks like. Here's our reactant. Here's our intermediate, which is the carbocation in resonance. And then we have our products. Now, which product is going to be lower than the other? And what is going to be lower now? Is the 1,2 or the 1,4 addition going to be lower in energy? 1,4? And that's because you have a more substituted double bond. So yes, internal double bonds, when you have comparing isomers, internal double bonds are thermodynamically more favorable than terminal double bonds. So the 1,4 addition product is here. And then let me make this note about the carbocation. The intermediate is a delocalized carbocation. There are not two separate carbocations. Any energy difference that occurs happens as the bond with bromide starts to form. So, two contrasting pathways that start out the same way. We have one reaction step that gets us to that delocalized carbocation, which will this will be one of the few times I write a structure this way. Notice the dotted line I put across three of the carbons. That's to show that you've got that delocalization across those three carbons. You will see that as a notation sometimes. I normally don't recommend it because in that dotted line, there's no indication of exactly how many electrons that you have. By experience, you would see the positive charge there, see that three atoms are involved, and the only way you could get a positive charge with three carbons that already have single bonds is if there's one pair of pi electrons across that whole system. But I'm telling you that's not obvious from the drawing. So that's why I normally don't like that notation. There's then a split in what happens. And I said that whatever energy difference is going to occur happens as the bond forms. So as that bond starts to form, you force a primary versus secondary carbocation. Which one is more favorable? The secondary one, correct? But that happens to be the one that leads to the less favorable product. And that's how we end up in this situation. Forcing a primary carbocation is less favorable. But once it happens, then we're going to end up with a more favorable product. Now we're ready for the last piece of this, which I know that there's a lot of lecture today. This is a multi-day lab, and the rest of the lab is fairly simple. It's this theory part that is tricky that does matter. And so I'm going to focus just on this last step, going from the carbocation to the product. And I'm going to hope I do all of this just as well tomorrow. Because in this diagram, there are four activation barriers we could worry about. There's the activation barriers going in the forward direction, and then there's the activation barriers going in the reverse direction. So these four constants I'm calling Ka forward, Ka reverse, Kb forward, Kb reverse. And here's the point. Did I just call those all K? Oh, good grief. This should be E's, but we're going to relate them to K's. Getting ahead of myself here. Because in this case, since the product is lower in energy than the intermediate that we start with, the reverse rates or the reverse activation barriers are both automatically larger than either of the forward reaction barriers. So we have the largest reverse barrier being from the thermodynamic product. Then the smaller reverse barrier from what we're going to call the kinetic product. That is bigger than the forward barrier for making the thermo, which is bigger than the forward barrier for making the kinetic. If those are the order of the activation energies, the rate constants are the reverse. But let's, since we're starting to run a little bit low on time, let me just make a summary here. At low enough temperature, a reaction can become effectively irreversible. And we can already see that the reverse barriers are larger than the forward barriers. In this situation, whichever forward reaction occurs more quickly is going to determine the product that forms. So since the energy for forming B is greater than the energy for forming A, and if I label these things A versus B, A will predominate. Even though thermodynamically it is not the most favorable product. And so we call that kinetic control. Because only the thing that forms easily, kinetically, is the thing that's going to form. Now, what happens when we start raising temperature? Well, all rates increase. All forward and reverse reaction rates increase. But it's still true that to get from what's called the thermodynamic product, what we're going to call that, the lower energy product, that still has the largest barrier of them all. So as you raise temperature, all these rates speed up, but all the other rates speed up more than that largest barrier. So over time, what happens is that if you form the kinetic product, if you form A, given enough temperature, it'll reverse backwards. It'll have another chance to react. Maybe because that forward kinetic barrier is still lower, you'll still form A again. But every once in a while, you'll form B instead. B is the lowest energy of any of these things, so it's the slowest to reverse. And so over time, you form more and more B. And so at high temperature, because you now have reversibility, B will form, which is the most favorable product, which is why it's called the thermodynamic product. And this is kinetic versus thermodynamic control. If you read through the text, this example that we had of forming the two different bromides, this is exactly what happens. At low temperature, you form more of the terminal alkene. At high temperature, you form more of the internal one. And this is the explanation why. Now let me write down that last bit that I just said about high temperature. At high temperature, all reaction rates increase. And the reaction can become reversible. This means the kinetic product may form initially, but has a chance to reverse and potentially form B. Since B is the lowest energy product, the rate of the reverse reaction is the lowest. So B will accumulate over time. Which is called thermodynamic control. Now we'll probably review this whole situation one more time. But let me move into what you're doing with the experiment now, since we got to start lab. And I'll skip over some of the details. We need to have a discussion of melting points. I know that we talked about melting points last quarter, but since that was a whole quarter ago, I'm guessing that you might need a quick brush up on theory and also on how to do these melting points. Because, yes, you have a lot of melting points for ones that you're going to have to take, because that's central to what we're doing in this experiment. Because in this experiment, you're going to have a competing reaction. You're going to have two different starting materials. Cyclohexanone and 2-furaldehyde. You're reacting both of them with semicarbazide. And you're going to form two different molecules. Oops. Let me just write them down below here. So semicarbazone is another imine-style derivative, just like oxime and hydrazone. Semicarbazones historically were important because they were very well-behaved, what are called derivatives. So if you can imagine that if at some point we did characterization by melting point, and there's a whole bunch of compounds that might have the same melting point, well, if you could figure out their functional group, like if you could determine that they were a ketone or an aldehyde somehow, you could then react it with the semicarbazide to make a very crystalline derivative. That derivative is going to have a distinct melting point compared to other derivatives. So let's say you had five different compounds that all happen to have the same melting point, but you were able to make derivatives of them, and they were each different derivatives. Well, then each of those derivatives might have a different melting point, which therefore means that by making the derivative, you could identify the original compound. So in fact, in some of the labs we've already done this quarter, I think there's an optional part where it says make the semicarbazide and take its melting point, but we skipped that. That's what that's related to. And I'll tell that story again when we've got more time. But that's historically where these semicarbazides often show up. They were often used as derivatives. Quick question here. Why might you imagine that it's the end nitrogen, the nitrogen furthest from the carbonyl, that ends up being the nitrogen that participates in this reaction? Because the mechanism you've seen, it's the modified protonate open attack deprotonate mechanism, identical to what we had when we made an imine. It's just that along with the nitrogen, we've got this other stuff in tow. Why was it not the nitrogen next to the carbonyl that reacted? There's a one-word answer. Very short word. Resonance. Because those lone pairs are in resonance with the carbonyl, which makes them less reactive. You have the nitrogen, which is further away, which is not conjugated, and that's why it's more reactive. So we're talking about conjugation, and I want to just point out another manifestation of its effects. So these form imine-style derivatives. These are semicarbazones. You're going to take the melting points, and you're doing it in several different ways. Part A and part B, you're making one of these, and then separately the other one. Is part A the cyclohexanone? Yes. So part A, you make the cyclohexanone semicarbazide, and in part B, you make the 2-furaldehyde semicarbazide. And then separately, you're going to measure those melting points. Now, let me take a quick look here, because I think we're doing this reduced quantity. Today, because we're only doing melting points. If we end up with so little material that for this lab you can't get percent yield, that's okay for this one lab. You just need the material to be able to do a melting point. So 1/5 quantities for everything. And by the way, for those of you who, if you came in late, if you didn't already bring it up, please bring your pre-lab up so I can check it before you get going. Part A, part B, you make the two individual compounds. Then what's part C about? You throw all three of these compounds together. You form both of the starting materials, the carbonyl-containing starting materials, at the semicarbazide because you want to see which one of these derivatives actually forms. And you do it at low temperature, and you do it at middle temperature, and you do it at high temperature. Let's suppose, you know, let's make an argument that conjugation helps stabilize the products. So maybe, let's guess, that B might be the thermodynamic product. I'm just guessing there. If that were true, then at low temperature, we'd expect to find more of the derivative of A. Because at low temperature, we would expect to find the kinetic product. And so when you do this part C reaction at low temperature, you take whatever forms and compare its melting point to the pure derivatives. If the melting point more closely matches A, that means more A formed. If it more closely matches B, it means more B formed. And so at low temperature, you expect it to look more like A, if A is the kinetic product. And at high temperature, you expect it to look more like B, if B is the thermodynamic product. And to make sure you've got your guess correct, that's what part E is for. Because part E, you take the product and you put it in the reaction condition that allows the reverse reaction to occur. If a reverse reaction occurs, that means you started with the kinetic product, which at high temperature reversed and went back to make the thermodynamic product. If nothing happens, you already had the thermodynamic product and it didn't want to go anywhere. That's how we're going to identify which one of these two processes is the kinetically favored process versus the thermodynamically favored process. Now, that aspect of it, I'm going to have to repeat because that's, well, going to be on your lab quiz. And I know I ran through that in the last 2 minutes here versus the whole big build-up to the topic. So you're just going to be making a bunch of solids, isolating them, and then I'd recommend not trying to start your melting points today. Do as much of your synthesis today as you could so that your products can dry out, because they have to be dry. They have to be completely isolated before you try to do melting point, because your whole result for this lab depends on melting point. Questions then? Are you supposed to be isolating all these different solids by vacuum filtration? We appear to have vacuum, thankfully. Yes? The Grignard lab. Oh, you need to still finish the workup for it? I'm more worried about the exam. So if you notice, I didn't talk about lab reports like I was supposed to today. So don't worry about the Grignard experiment today. Worry about starting this lab. And then next time we could, let's see, today's Tuesday, so you do have Thursday. So next time we'll worry about finishing off the Grignard lab. But in other words, due date for the Grignard lab is totally up in the air, so worry about starting the day's experiment first. Now, I'll open up the IR room if anybody does have product that you're ready to characterize, but focus on this lab first.